Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we turn our attention to the remarkable prophecy contained in Yeshaya 17, Kirk, who has joined us, I have a question for you, Kirk. You so accurately summarized the situation in the Ukraine, where American taxpayers are now asked to pay for Ukrainians and to supply them with all manner of debt. Did you claim the Ukrainians as a new dependent on this year's tax filing?
No, but we're going to have to do that, I think, if they're going to keep giving them money. It's only fair.
It does seem only fair, doesn't it? You know,
I don't know if they'll reject it or not, but it seems like somebody ought to try it.
Yeah, you know, my children are still dependents in a way. I mean, both of them are gainfully employed. They don't ask for dad and mom to help them out, but you know there are kids, and that's what we enjoy doing. So you know we help them with their whether it be their homes, or we help them with their business ventures and their schooling and the like. But you know we chose to have them, we chose to raise them, we enjoy particularly since they're gainfully employed and making a positive contribution to their communities. We don't mind choosing to have them as dependent. We don't even deduct them on our tax return. Why was I given the Ukrainian? I mean, I don't remember voting to say, you know, I really want these bad boys. Their anti-Semitism and their tendency to riot and to have revolutions every 10 years seems perfect to me, so I would really like to adopt them.
Well, why can't we do with the Ukrainians and just tell the all our people that we've borrowed money from just not going to pay them back anymore? Most of it's federal government. I mean, Federal Reserve,
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, why don't we
write them a letter and say, here's
an IRU,
and let you know we don't. Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
And see how they like it, you know.
Yeah, let's tell the Federal Reserve. Why not? They're the biggest holder of U.S. debt right now. Is the Federal Reserve with quantitative easing? Yellen came out this morning and said that she's going to continue to advance easy money. Let's tell her that you didn't actually do anything for the money, and it wasn't your money in the first place, so we're just not going to pay you back.
If you ordered us to print it, I mean, don't they order the Treasury Department to print it, so we pay for the dollar?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, now a very small percentage of money is actually printed.
Really,
it's almost
dollars.
Yeah, it's all electronic. It's the money is not worth the paper it's printed on, so they just create the illusion of money. But can you imagine if we actually had a democracy? And that's the difference between a republic and a democracy. There were two democracies in human history. I think only two. One was Sparta, which was repulsive, of course, and the other one was the Delian League, which failed because it tried to impose choice on all of the neighboring islands as a defense mechanism against the Persians. That in a democracy, it's always been an oligarchy, never been all citizens, because they realized that unless you had an investment in the country's decision, unless you were paying the bills, that you really should not decide where the money was spent. Those two oligarchies lasted for 200 or 300 years, depending on which one you're speaking of. But in those cases, the people actually decided whether or not they wanted to go off to war. They decided if they were going to loan somebody money. Can you imagine what would happen in America if you were to ask the people, hey, do you want to go off and invade Iraq? Do you want to go off and invade Afghanistan? Do you think we ought to bomb Damascus? Do you think we ought to send $25 billion to the Ukrainians? Will that make life in America better?
Well, you know, I grew up in Australia, even though I'm from Alabama originally, and I got my notice at 18 that I needed to come back to defend California coast from the Vietnam invasion.
Yeah.
But they drafted me there, you know, because this terrible army was going to attack us. I don't think they asked me what I'd like to do then. They just said, you know, stop what you're doing and come back.
Come back, yeah. You know, we have determined that we're going to invade Vietnam. And by us invading Vietnam, that will keep the Vietnamese, I suppose, from invading the United States. Because I'm quite certain that one of those river boats that they operate in Vietnam was capable of cruising across the Pacific Ocean and landing on the coast of California and invading. And they could have brought enough Vietnamese here to officially occupy this country. Made perfect sense to me. And, of course, we sacrificed 60,000 Americans, making a bad situation worse in Vietnam, and didn't learn a thing from it.
Well, so that's also the wounded and the mentally impaired.
Well, you've got to add them. You got to add them to it.
Hundreds of thousands, yeah.
Hundreds of thousands. Well, we should study those ill-fated invasions, whether it be Vietnam or Korea or Afghanistan or Iraq, and realize that we made bad situations worse at the cost of hundreds of thousands of lives. According to Yanoa, those wars will be small by comparison to what's coming. And what's coming is going to occur because of the malfeasance of countries like the United States. And so as I read Yashaya 17:13, I want you to think, realize that Kerry is back in Israel, demanding that Israel give up the West Bank. And the West Bank isn't just that part of Israel that is between Jerusalem and the Jordan River. What is called the West Bank actually proceeds to within 5 miles of the Mediterranean Ocean. And it narrows Israel at the waist to the point where it is unsustainable as a country, which God's already told us. And we know what Muslims have had the history to do when they think that Israel is vulnerable. They attack. And so it is this plan, trading land, which Israel has way too little of, for promises of peace, which Muslims have never known and never offered anyone, that is being sponsored by the United States. And when it makes Israel vulnerable, whose country's weapons are going to be brought to bear against the chosen people?
Ours.
Ours. Yeah, you know, we claim to be this peaceful, peace-loving nation, a force for good, and yet the United States is overwhelmingly, by a factor of about 5 times, the world's largest arms merchant in the world. And we supply 25 times more weaponry. When you monitorize weaponry, we supply 25 times more weapons to Israel's Islamic enemies than we do to Israel. So we're reaching a period of time, we probably already reached it, where the collective force of Team Islam is going to be not only outnumber the Israelis 100-1, which they've always done, but they're going to outgun them 25-1. And Israel will be defenseless. So this is what God says is going to happen. The people of these nations, these are populations groups which gather together, and no population group gathers together as resolutely as do Muslims, will be like the horrible uproar, the shamon, the brawling and crying out of the rebellious and confused, the riotous loud roar and chaos of the waters, of the floodwaters, massively great, widespread and abundant, will be their devastation and desolation. Their sha'ah will be their desire to ruin everything while they strive to lay waste, giddy in the process as they crash into the land as a massive raging storm. The blaring and fearsome noise they make as they rush at great speed while destroying. But he will rebuke them, issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. And so they will be forced to flee on account of being alienated. And they will be chased just as the chaff on the hills before the approaching presence of the Spirit, like a tumbleweed before the approaching presence of the storm. So here, Kirk, we've got some interesting statements. It says that, and this is in conjunction with several other statements that God has made about the fact that it's going to be a great number of nations and a multitude of people from those nations who are going to flood into Israel. So from that alone, we can surmise that the 50 majority Islamic nations are all likely to participate. They're all either going, the majority Islamic nations will probably act nationally, declaring war against Israel. While another at least 50 nations with a meaningful Islamic minority will send jihadists, even though the nations themselves may or may not declare war against Israel.
Do you think the Asians will, where there's a big Muslim population, do you think they'll be able to get there for the battle?
Yes, because the way that the battle is presented here, God constantly reinforces the fact that they're going to come across the sea. They're going to flood into Israel. They're going to crash into Israel from the sea. And so you can do an analysis of where they're going to come from and how they're from the Caucasus regions, for example. They're going to sail through the Caspian, through the Black Sea, through the Bosphorus Straits into the Aegean and down into the Mediterranean, and that's how they're going to get to Israel. It's the most effective way for them to get to Israel. You look at the Indonesian and the Malaysian Muslims. They're going to sail through the Indian Ocean. Hey, they may even spot
Saudi Arabia.
The Mission airliner on the way, and then they'll simply go around the tip of the Arabian Peninsula and up through the Red Sea and enter Israel from the south. Then you have all of the Islamic countries like Tunisia and Morocco and Libya and Egypt and the countries directly underneath them that are now being ravaged by fundamentalist Islam. And they will come up, many of them, across the Suez Canal, cruising up and then crashing into Israel from there. And so or just sailing across the Mediterranean itself, because many border on the Mediterranean. And then you'll have jihadists from America and from Europe that will climb aboard boats taking them to Israel. So, yes, I think it's when God says that.
Totally surrounded.
Yeah, he says many nations are going to participate. There are 50 majority Islamic nations and another 50 nations where Islam is a very either significant percentage or they represent, there are millions of Muslims in those countries. All 100 of those countries, I think, will participate in one way or another. And ultimately, well, we can do an analysis, and I think it's 150 million Muslims that are going to crash into Israel. Welcome back to Shattering Israel. I have a discussion with Kirk on God's prediction that the Muslims who are going to attack Israel are going to, A, come from many nations, B, a massive force, and he repeats the massive number of people that are going to participate and the great number of nations that are going to provide jihadists, while also consistently using terms which speak of waves of terrorists crashing into the shore and being a tidal wave, a flood, if you will, of terrorists that cannot be stopped. Now, so collectively, I've gotten to the point, Kirk, that I'm sure you have, to realize that Yahweh is an extraordinarily skilled wordsmith. That he chooses words that convey precisely what he's trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's lots of words for noise, but he's used every word that combines noisy with waves of noise makers, if you will, the noise, the roar of the sea. And he's done so because these terrorists are going to crash ashore into the land from the sea. Going to flood into Israel in numbers that becomes unstoppable. You ever try to stop a flood? Have you ever seen anyone, any community, any state, any place be effective at stopping a flood?
You ain't going to stand there and push it back. I mean,
no.
You know, it reminds me, too, I had a teacher that worked for me once, and he was in 17. When he was 17, they sent him to Korea, and he fought in that rather big mm-hmm. battle. And he described it for me, and without going in too much detail, the Chinese came down in thousands upon thousands, and they didn't even have guns. They had wooden cutout guns.
Because
they didn't have enough guns. They didn't have enough guns for them, and there was only a few thousand of the American soldiers, and,
right.
and they couldn't stop them, because they would either get shot by them or they get shot by the Chinese. So they would march down the hill, and when there's so many, and there
right.
was hundreds of thousands, when there was so many, they just roar down the hill and just overwhelm you, and that's what
yes.
I picture when you know
yes.
even more so when you read that passage.
You know, there's about 6 million Jews in Israel, 6.2 million, something in that range. The number of Jews in Israel just passed the number of Jews living in the United States this year. And so 6 million Jews in Israel. Let's assume that that 70%, 60% to 70% of them are old enough or young enough to be part of the Israeli Defense Forces. I mean, it's pretty hard to engage a kid that's younger than 10, and it's pretty hard to engage a fellow that's older, say, than 60. Although, you know, I'm approaching 60 now, and I'm not sure that I would be discarded for being completely feeble. But nonetheless,
we're in our prime.
we're not in our prime, but that doesn't mean that we can be
dead.
Yeah, we're not dead yet. But recognizing that, let's just say then that there are 4 million Jews that could actually participate in their defense. 4 million, even using the most advanced weapons in the world, how are they going to stop 150 million?
You can't.
You can't.
No.
You have not enough bullets.
They're not enough. How they would melt, you see.
Right, right. Yeah, you could not load and fire and supply ammunition to guns rapidly enough to deal with 150 million. And by the way, we're not dealing with just jihadists and carrying weapons. And in this case, unlike the North Koreans, and they're not going to have pretend guns. The United States, through Qatar and Saudi Arabia, has armed them to the hilt. They have not only real guns, assault rifles, and lots of ammunition for them. They also have surface-to-air missiles. They have anti-tank, anti-personnel rocket-propelled devices. They have rocket-propelled grenades. They have 50-caliber machine guns.
Well, they have tanks, too.
And they have tanks. We've supplied them with tanks. We've supplied them with artillery. All for the Syrian proxy war, and those jihadists are simply going to turn on Israel when they're done. But beyond that, we've sent just Saudi Arabia alone over $100 billion of our most advanced weaponry, our fighter jets and our tanks, our missiles. And with Pakistan, we provide them with $5 billion worth of military hardware every year. In Egypt, we provide them with $3 billion every year. So, you know, you're talking about a force so large that the Israeli Defense Forces can't stop it. And God is warning Israel. Now, 2,750 years before this occurs, that it's going to occur, that you're not going to be able to stop it, that it's going to be devastating, a flood of Islamic jihadists, armed to the teeth, shouting Allahu Akbar, destroying everything in their way. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It's amazing to me, Kirk, that God provided this warning to Israel, and yet there's no one in Israel listening. You know, if you think about it, there's only one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that is available to us intact. Now, you know, there's probably 30 manuscripts of Devarim, Deuteronomy, because it was so popular. But there's not one of those manuscripts that is complete from beginning to end. There's only one scroll amongst the many hundreds, if not thousands, of scrolls that we have fragments from the Dead Sea that is intact from beginning to end, and that's Yeshaya, Isaiah.
And so, just accidental?
No, I don't think so, because it points exactly. It tells us exactly what we need to know, and it's this scroll is actually now in its entirety. It was put around a round building was made specifically to display it. And it's been photographed, and every word of it's available to read online. And here God is saying unequivocally that Israel's going to be dissected as a result of the consequence of the Syrian war, and forced to give up land for peace. And yet the Israelis are negotiating with the Americans to do this very thing. And it says that immediately thereafter, that these hordes of Muslims are going to flood into Israel, and that Israel will be defenseless, and that there is nothing that Israel is going to be able to do to stop them. And yet they still spend a disproportionate amount of their gross domestic product on their military. You know, wouldn't you think that somewhere along the way you'd read what God has to say and choose to rely on him and say, you know, it worked during Hezekiah's day. I think I'm going to trust you. Why don't you deal with them?
May I ask a question? You know, the stuff that you sent me on this passage, mm-hmm. I gave to a friend, and mm-hmm. it blew him away. I mean, he only got into about 20-something pages of it the last time I talked to him. It kind of blew mm-hmm. him away. That's so powerful. Is that posted? I mean, it's something I would recommend to all the listeners. You know.
Read, yeah. It isn't posted yet because I have finished my translations of it, and I finished my initial commentary because, you know, my whole mindset, Kirk, as you know, is, I love to translate what God has to say, and particularly in an amplified way so we consider the fullness of what he's communicating. My real pleasure, my sense of personal pursuit of learning, of discovering, is to be able to correlate what God is saying. You know, for example, if he says that Syria is going to cease to be a nation, I want the reader to understand, and I want to understand what that means in a prophecy that's 2,700 years old. How long through the last 2,750 years ago, because this was committed to paper in 750 BCE. How much of that time did Syria exist as a government that could fall? And then when God says that Israel is going to be dissected in the midsection, and he speaks of Jacob, which is the whole of Israel, beginning in 750 BCE, the northern kingdom was already gone.
Gone, yeah.
Right? So when did Israel become whole again? For how much time was Israel whole again for this to even happen? So I find myself motivated to write on what God is saying to for my own edification. I want to understand what this is. And long story short, where I am right now is that because this prophecy is so powerful, after going through everything, I presented it again at the end of the chapter. And at the end of the chapter, where I presented it one last time, I'm trying now to say, all right, so here's not only what God said, but here's the order of things and how that order is relevant. And let's consider our future as it is presented in these words. And I'm about three quarters through doing that. And, you know, with the show taking up so much time during the day now, I don't have quite as much time to devote to it. And I hope in the next 2 weeks to get that finished. And as soon as it's finished, then we're going to post it. But it's not yet posted. You have been so good to call this program and have added so much character and depth to it that I sent you and Larry, who does the same thing, an advanced copy of it. But what you currently have is incomplete and is undergoing editing. Kirk, while we're talking about this, we have a first-time caller, Tiffany from Colorado. And, boy, did I just make a mistake, Kirk, and I apologize. I didn't lock you in prior to bringing Tiffany on live, so I'd appreciate it, Kirk, if you wouldn't mind calling back. That was my mistake. But, Tiffany, the program is yours. I understand you're a first-time caller calling in from Colorado. What have we said, or what would you like to know that we may have not said?
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Sure.
I have been around listening to you and you reading the transcripts and everything,
mm-hmm.
Everything for several years.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I've been listening to everything for the last 2 weeks or so,
mm-hmm.
Off the radio program. and my heart is just breaking, to be fair. And because I love Yah with everything that I am, and I have all of my life.
So why is your heart breaking if you've come to know and love Yahweh?
Because most of my life I've kind of had this vision of how things would go, you know, get married, have the nice house, the kids, the whole, you know, the whole.
Yes. Yeah, we all. Right. Yeah, we all. We all have our visions as how our mortal lives ought to go. And and as you know, Tiffany, there's probably one in a million whose life actually goes the way they thought it ought to go. And even then, you know, it isn't necessarily all smiles.
No, and I have always had kind of a little bit of a hard time relinquishing my. My hold on how I want my mortal life to go. Don't really know why. Just kind of always hold on to this thing.
Yeah, well, I think we all have. We all want everything to be ideal. And for example, some of the things in Yahweh's presentation that he asks us to do differently than society would have them do them. You know, put some of our American dream, if you will, in quotes, agenda in serious jeopardy.
Yeah. And I mean, I've walked away. I dabbled a tiny bit in government actions and walked away from that. Spent my entire, for two thirds of my natural life, I wanted to be a youth pastor and I spent many years working in the church. Walked away from that. You know,
And by the way, so we're similar in this. I spent most of my youth involved as an editor, as a elder in the Presbyterian Church and as a church leader and a Bible study leader and an evangelism teacher, and walked away from all of that as well. So we're on similar ground here in both of these two things. I was really active in politics. So far, your past and my past are fortunately in both of our paths.
They are. And I was sharing with a close friend, I believe, of you and myself, and I stood to him last night. I said, I drove past this church that I almost had a job at, and I actually became violently ill yesterday.
Mm.
And I was like, I am so thankful that it happened the way it did, you know, that I got out when they did, that I've had the last 7 years to really, you know, figure out how to do Passover and all of the other set of heart holidays.
Well, you and me are once again in sharing similar ground. I often wonder, as deep as I was mired in politics and in business and in religion, that I've been able to leave these things. I can't give myself any credit. Yeah, I was open. I was willing to spend the time to learn, and I loved getting to know Yahweh and searching His Word and understanding what He had to say. But still, you almost shake your head and say, boy, if it weren't just for God making Himself available, I never would have come to know Him. And oh man, how different and worse life would have been. So, I'm right here with you. It's been such a joy coming to know God as He is and coming to understand the covenant as He explained it to us, and so liberating mostly, you know, so empowering.
Well, I like God better.
Yes. I like the real one a lot better than the religious one.
I do. I like the real one a lot better.
Yeah, me too.
But the part where, and the reason why I was calling is.
Yes.
Despite the fact that I love God more, I feel like I know Him better. I feel freer than I've ever felt in my life. The one thing that I'm having the hardest time with is that I'm at that wonderful age where becoming a mother is something I thought naturally happened.
Right.
You know, if everybody asked me, oh, well, what did you want to do when you grew up?
Yeah.
I would say wife and mother.
Yes.
That was it.
And that's, by the way, that is extraordinarily appropriate. I mean, we were conceived to want this. And, you know, I'm the last person in the world that is sexist. But that being the case, I do think that Yahweh conceived us especially so that men would value the idea of becoming dads, and that women would value love becoming mothers, and that they would that both men and women would see enormous sense of fulfillment and satisfaction and joy in being a parent. So the fact that you want deeply to be a mom and to experience that is exactly as it should be.
But I also have a few brain cells left.
Yes.
A few. And I look at the world as it is, and I've listened to the last 2 weeks especially, mainly, you know, the archived messages. And I just, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I want that more than I've wanted anything else in my life. And yet, I just don't know how I could be a responsible mother and bring a child into that.
Well, you know, we're going to have 6 minutes to discuss this in our next segment, and I want to discuss it with you. I'm going to share something with you that might be a bit of a surprise, but please, Tiffany, if you can stay over for the our final section today, we're going to talk about whether it's loving and responsible to bring a new child into this world today. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In our concluding moment, we're going to talk to Tiffany about really a very thoughtful and emotional topic. This reminds me a little about Jefferson, as he used to write those soaring prose about the debate that he had between his heart and his head. I don't know if you ever read Jefferson's writings, but it is really profound and motivating what he had to say in this debate between head and heart, and that's what you're having, Tiffany. Before I answer and provide you with some my thoughts on this, Tiffany, I encourage you to write me a note at yada@yadayah.com, and I want to pass it on to the husband and wife team that did four shows while I was gone. James and his wife Patty did the programs on circumcision and then on Pesach and Matzah. They are in your situation. They are members of Yahweh's covenant family. Love Yahweh dearly. Going to spend eternity with us in Yahweh's home. They are in the midst of contemplating this very same decision. And we have had many conversations together. Here is something I want you to think about, Tiffany. You were conceived to cherish being a mom. It's the single most important aspect of God's design for you. And the same is true with men. We were designed to want to be dads, to be fathers. And all the kinds of things that go around this idea of getting married, having a home, raising children, that is how we were designed by God to love one another and to engage in this way. And we were designed in this way so that we would understand and appreciate and want to participate in His covenant family. This isn't a small thing. It's the single most important aspect of our design. God wants to be our dad, and so for us to understand and appreciate the role He wants to play in our lives, He created us so that we would value being parents. So this is no small thing that you desire to do. This is not a legacy from a previous life. This is how you were created.
Now, I've always felt that way.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's by the way, it's the greatest job in the world, being a parent.
But it didn't matter what careers I chose or how I made a manage of paying for bills or anything along those lines. It was always, you know, everybody always asked me in the different careers that I've had. Because I'm 33 and I've had, you know, I would like to say I've had a career crisis at least once.
Yeah, so most of us.
A couple times.
Right.
And, and I'm happy with where I'm at. But it's,
right.
It's,
and, you know, and valuing being a mom, that prioritizing that, isn't in conflict with engaging in business and doing your thing.
Right.
It's not a conflict with that. We're not saying that all women should stay at home and be mothers. I'm putting men and women in exactly the same situation here, that we were designed to come together in marriage and to build a family and to devote ourselves to raising children so that we would come to appreciate Yahweh and His covenant. That's how we were designed. Now, that being the case, here's the you mentally know that the world over the next 12 years until we are harvested by God as His covenant children, and over the next then 22 years is going to be vastly different, or less than that. We're now, I should say, 19 years. So we have 12 years and 19 years.
Right.
That this world is going to continue to devolve. It's going to deteriorate rapidly. One of the things that I was happy to find in Jeremiah, in the analysis that I did for it for an introduction to God, was Yahweh specifically says that the children of those who have embraced the covenant are considered to be part of His family. Which means that at this point, if a 9 months from now, you were to give birth to a lovely boy or girl, your son or daughter would only be 11 years old when this harvest that is predicted in this particular prophecy occurs. And at that time, their eternal fate would be determined based upon your personal commitment to the covenant, your relationship with Yahweh. And so you would have the opportunity of getting to know them and join your son or daughter, and your son or daughter would live eternally with God. It's the best of all worlds.